Buddhist Summer School, Monday, 12th August, 1985. Venerable members of the Sangha and fellow wayfarers in the Dhamma. So far, we have considered faith and the clear seeing of the Dhamma. Today, let us consider virtue, the third factor which Sariputta recommends the wise man to cultivate. What does the word virtue mean? It is derived from the Latin vir, which means a man, and virtus, which means strength, courage in a man. In the English language, virtue has come to mean excellence of any kind, merit, worth, value. This excellence implies for us perfection psychophysically, specifically purity in thought and feeling, speech and bodily action. We may conveniently regard virtue as soul strength. Its source is the transcendent power of pure mind, Huang Po's absolute. So we may regard virtue as the excellence of certain qualities distinguishing the healed, the holy psyche. All such qualities are classed as good, supremely good. Their opposites constitute unvirtuousness, immorality, evil. The good which is virtue is that which leads to satisfaction, satisfaction spiritually, to fulfillment or fruition. This takes time. Therefore, the self must continue to exist. Since it is impossible to remain an unchanging person, there is inevitably a becoming process whereby satisfaction may be reached. So, the preservation of the self through time is the first priority. This involves everything concerned with food and drink, exercise, rest, and all the rest of it. To live sensibly, treating the body in the right way, not ill-treating it by making it do impossible things, breaking athletic records and whatnot and whatnot. Whatever preserves the self, whatever gives satisfaction or leads to fulfillment or fruition is therefore good. It is virtue. But as satisfaction is obtained, there is pleasure and a growing craving for more pleasure, even spiritually. Thus, kama tanha, the binding attachment to pleasure lust, arises. When the satisfaction takes the form of winning against, and thus being superior to, an opposing creature or circumstance, bhava tanha, power lust, and ego conceit arise. As and when the thwarting of satisfaction takes place, conflict, aversion, hatred, and war arise. But in the age of the reptiles, It was virtue to preserve the self and win one's mate by killing the enemy or the rival. Of course, there were no humans then. It was virtue for the reptiles to live like that. And in the age of the mammals, to preserve the self, win the mate, and protect one's young by killing the enemy or defeating the rival. It was virtue. But this was virtue several hundred million years ago, when there were no humans in the world. Then came the primates, out of whom we evolved, and we bear in our brains the reptilian and mammalian heritage of the evolutionary process. As with killing and subjugating the weak and inferior, it was virtue then to take as if by right whatever was necessary or was desired for the preservation of the self without any by your leave, kind sir or madam. Had it not been so, the animal world would have perished for lack of food, shelter and warmth. Long after we came upon the scene, a human here and a human there realized human fruition only a few thousand years ago. We humans as such, two-legged creatures, walking freely and so forth, started only 3.5 million years ago. He saw a vision, and then the first commandment laid down, or the advice given, was not to kill, not to harm life, for life and living were and are the middle step of the three steps which mark the cosmic journey. Compare the three steps of Vishnu, those who have read that. First, creating. Second, living and learning and loving. And third, fulfilling and finishing. The Buddha's wise and loving first precept, Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami, meaning I undertake the rule of training to refrain from injury to living things, has had a 600 million year time span for its development and emergence, and is of worldwide significance and practical application. And so too with the second precept, Adinnabana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami, I undertake the rule of training to refrain from taking what is not given. You see the wideness of the first sila. To refrain from injury to living things. But in the Brahmajala Sutta, as it proceeds with the moralities, the Buddha also mentions harming plants and so forth. You know how some people, when they go walking through a woodland, take their walking stick and slash away at branches and so forth. If humanity today were to live by those two precepts, we would be free of some of our most difficult problems, such as preserving peace in the world and the population explosion, together with some of their associated consequences. The other three precepts which specially concern the human species, if observed, would enable mankind to live healthily and happily, apart from the pain and sorrow consequent upon natural disasters and epidemics. We can't do anything about earthquakes and floods and so on. They just happen. As regards the third precept, which advises refraining from kamesu michachara, I feel that to confine the translation of those words to sexual immorality is a mistake. It would be well worthwhile to study the exposition given of the word kama in the Pali Text Society's Pali English Dictionary, starting on page 31 of part 3. There were 8 volumes when it first came out. For our purpose today, let us use the term sense desires as the meaning of kama. We have 5 bodily senses plus the intellectual and aesthetic activity of the discursive mind. Each of the senses has the essential role in the pleasure derived from its functions. For example, sight in connection with painting, with the form of a human being or an animal or a building, or with the beauty of nature, sometimes so ethereal, at other times so massive. Smell and taste with food and drink and the sweet scents of flowers or of man-made perfumes. Hearing with music made by man or bird, by breeze or stream. Touch through contact with earth or grass or trees or man-made materials or with human beings, and so on ad infinitum. Added to the sensuous aspect is the psychical aspect, the aesthetic and intellectual delight, and in the case of great art or deep religious experience, the spiritual ecstasy. Often there is the delight of several senses functioning in concert, as when your baby, cradled in your arms, is burbling sweet nothings in response to your crooning. Don't you think this happened with the parents of Gautama and Jesus, and Milarepa and Lao Tzu and scores of other holy ones? It is not the senses and their proper functioning, nor the calmly observed enjoyment derived therefrom, which are at fault. Calmly observed delight. It is the bondage of craving for the repeated expression of sense desire, tanha, which is the poisoning element in the whole of sense life, which is the trouble. This craving is tied up with all sensuous experience and not exclusively with sex. I know this from my own experience, the way in the years when I was engaged with music. I went to 36 concerts in 1923 for the promenade season. Absolutely gorged myself with it. Greed. And it was the same with books throughout my life until a few years ago. So I would regard refraining from kamesu michachara as refraining from unbridled indulgence in all sensuous delights. Unbridled indulgence, remember. Speaking to the bhikkhus assembled in the Ambalattika Park situated between Rajagaha and Nalanda, the Buddha gives a long list of all the things from which he himself refrains. He calls it the minor details of mere morality. This comes in the Brahmajala Sutta and in the Chulahathipadopama Sutta. He gives a similar discourse to the Brahman Janusoni, who was chaplain to the king. Science has investigated the pleasure areas in the brain and shown that pleasure is necessary for good health. The religious, of course, eschews the pursuit of sensational, lustful delights confined to the wild urges of the body, leading to frenzied excitement. In the Brahmayu Sutta, the Brahman youth Uttara says, the revered Gotama eats food experiencing its flavor, enjoying its flavor, but not experiencing greed for the flavor. And when he has eaten, he sits silent for a moment, but he does not let pass the time for giving thanks. When he has finished eating, he gives thanks. He sits silent, and I believe the bhikkhus all also sat silent. They do so still, don't they? There you are. Now, can we learn that lesson? It is the same in the other religions too. In Zarathustrianism, for instance, you ate in silence. Because eating is a mode of communion with the nourishment that Mother Earth gives us. And one must eat mindfully. Can you be mindful if you are making a devil of a row? The arahant, the religious, with senses purified and pacified, experiences endless pleasure. For now the senses, having become the cords of communion with the total reality, are avenues of a peaceful, constant happiness, of an intensity, a sensitivity, and a quality which utterly transcends any and every sensational pleasure experienced by the worldling. If you realize this happiness, you will know part of the meaning of the term the subtle senses as presented in the Sankhya philosophy. You will realize the health, wholeness, and holiness of the human organism, and your brain will never obstruct clear-sighted vision of the truth. The pure religious is the happy being, the good human. Happiness and goodness are inseparables. The fourth precept, to refrain from speech that is lying, and expanded in the Brahmajala and the Chulahathipadopama Sutta, to include speech that is slanderous, harsh, frivolous, and the fifth precept, to refrain from liquors which engender slothfulness, need no exposition. We are all well aware of all that. In the modern world, we must also add drugs, which have become a terrible problem. Now perhaps we may get the feel of what virtue means, particularly its transcendent nature. Sariputta advised, cultivate virtue. I beg leave to say, we cannot cultivate virtue. I cannot cultivate what I haven't got to start with. But if the beginnings are there, if the seeds are there, then I can cultivate. We cannot cultivate virtue because we do not really know, we are not actually conscious of what virtue is. We know the words, we know some thoughts associated with the words which represent the virtues. But we are not really conscious of it. If we are really conscious, then naturally and spontaneously, inevitably and invariably, that virtue will express itself through all our ordinary existential life. That is something which people don't understand. So they have to sort of fight with themselves in order to be virtuous. You can't force yourself to be virtuous. It is easy enough for me to say, virtue is that archetypal form of the primordial creative energy which persuasively brings everything in the manifested universe to perfection, that is, to its fruition, so that the purpose or purposes of its existence are happily and beautifully fulfilled. It is easy to say these words, but am I clearly conscious of their profound import and immense potency? If I am not, how can I cultivate that which is transcendent to me, which means hidden from me, which is beyond my ken? But our teacher, all our teachers, like the Lord God, are merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. This is from Exodus. Zarathustra used the Avastan word Asha. The Rig Vedic seers and the Upanishadic teachers used Ritha. Hinduism used Dharma and the Buddha used Dhamma. Fundamentally, all those words mean the eternal law and order, the truth. The root of the word dharma is dhri, meaning to uphold. What is it that is upheld? The orderly living process of the whole cosmos. That which the Buddha preached, the Dhamma, as did all the holy ones, each in their own language, was the order of law of the universe, uncreated, eternal, and you find the word eternal in the Dhammapada, the fifth verse, hatred ceases not by hatred, hatred ceases by not hatred. This is the law eternal. Immanent, not merely as interpreted by him or invented or decreed by him, that is the Buddha, but intelligible to any mind like his, utterly purified, not liable to delusion, seeing the truth with unerring insight, buddhi. I always translate buddhi as unerring insight, not as intuition. Intuition is a very poor word for this sort of thing. Hitler had his intuitions, and see what he did with them. Buddhi also means having clear consciousness, transcendentally, of the whole reality. All this is beyond a simple, ordinary mortal like myself. Only as the Sammāsambuddha could I be clearly conscious of it. But this truth, this law eternal, this transcendent energy, this perfect virtue is wholly embodied in me, in you, in each and everything and creature in the cosmos. It is the source of the moral imperative in us. Our task is to wake up to it and allow it to function freely through us. Like all the perfected holy ones, the Buddha showed the way. the full and successful treading of the way releases this dormant virtue, a transcendent power that opens the doors of the deathless. We, as we are, do not know virtue in its positive, stainless, divinely enlightening nature or state. What we do know is the unvirtuous, the ill state, dukkha, expressed in the faultiness of our daily, indeed hourly, thinking, feeling, speaking, and doing. With superb psychological insight, the Buddha saw all this with faultless clarity, knowing that we humans were stained psychically. He poured out the healing waters of truth to cleanse us of all foulness. What are these healing, cleansing waters? Essentially, his teaching of Samasati and Samasamadhi. Perfect watchfulness crowned by perfect communion. So, to translate samadhi as concentration is somewhat inadequate, I think. It is too narrow. Samadhi is this all togetherness, the complete togetherness. It needs, of course, the power of attention which brings about this complete togetherness. That's why I call it communion in the supreme sense. Approximately 513 years after Gautama's death, Jesus said, "Watch therefore, for ye know neither the day nor the hour wherein the Son of Man cometh." Son of Man means son of mind, son of Buddha, or of Bodhi, son of the Absolute. Some 7 or 8 centuries before the birth of Gautama, Zarathustra said in his Ushtavaiti Gatha, "When the divine mind encircled me completely, he declared to me that silent meditation is best for spiritual enlightenment." Note carefully, silent meditation. There's a tremendous meaning. I've tried to bring that out in the book on Zarathustra. It's in the chapter on immortality, chapter 4. Our task then is something like this. If some filth has fouled a perfectly clean room, we cannot sprinkle a stuff called cleanliness in order to clean it. We have to remove the filth in order to restore the room to its original, natural, clean state. To be virtuous, that virtue which is transcendentally embodied in us, is our natural state actually, but we are not awake to it. Even so, the natural embodied virtue in us is besmirched with our kilesas, the defilements of the mind, which we can see and deal with. And then the purified psyche will enable the light of pure mind to shine through the whole living process of our existential being. We say, we use these terms, my mind, his mind, your mind, and so forth. Not a single person has a mind. We all have a psyche. Mind is a cosmic, universal energy, an archetypal form of the primordial creative energy, which, contacting matter, the body, gives rise to psyche. This psyche has its roots in the brain and nervous system and in the Douglas glands particularly, these three. And this psyche manifests imperfectly pure mind. So we have all these defilements of the mind present in us. In the Dhammadayada Sutta, Sariputta gives the monks a list of 16 defilements: greed, ill will, anger, malevolence, hypocrisy, spite, envy, stinginess, deceit, treachery, obstinacy, impetuosity, conceit, arrogance, pride, and indolence. In the Vatthupama Sutta, the Buddha gives the same list to the monks, adding covetousness as the 17th defilement. Both Sariputta and the Buddha admonish the monks to get rid of these evils by treading the way. It is the 7th feature of the way, Samasati, perfect mindfulness, which specifically instructs us how to deal with these evils when they arise and assail us. In the Dvaita Vittaka Sutta, the Buddha recounts his own experience and method while he was still the Bodhisattva, not yet fully awakened. It occurred to him, he says, to sort out his mental states into two groups: the one consisting of craving for sense pleasures, moods of malevolence and thoughts of harming, and the other group consisting of renunciation of pleasure, feelings of goodwill, and thoughts of harmlessness. Remaining diligent, ardent, and self-possessed, he saw clearly that pleasure lust was conducive to the hurt of others and also the hurt of oneself, that it was destructive of insight, distressful, not conducive to Nibbana. Through such sustained reflection, the ill states subsided. How do you tackle the ill in oneself? Don't fight against it. Watch the storm. The storm will subside ultimately. No storm continues forever. And in that watching, there is a healing power which transforms the psychical energy which is expressing itself as evil into a healthy psychical energy which is good. Through such sustained reflection, the ill states subsided, the Buddha said, even as any and every storm, however violent, always comes to an end. One may argue, but just as storms arise again and again, whenever the atmospheric conditions which produce storms reappear, and indeed they do so in the physical world, what is there to prevent the recurrence of psychical ill states when evil psychical influences are present? This is a very pertinent question. The answer seems to be that by resolute practice, one becomes so clearly conscious that such and such ill states are evil that those evils cannot find lodgment in the psyche. The psyche has become so purified by that clear consciousness, by that enlightenment, that there is nothing in the psychophysical organism which can attract or allow entry to any evil. The situation is something like this. If you make a ball of soft earth and hurl it at a rock, it would merely be scattered as so much sand, leaving the rock unmoved. So too, whatever evil influences may be present, the pure psyche remains untainted, perfectly tranquil, rock firm, kutastha. That word comes in the Upanishads. The fruit of virtue is true knowledge. As long as one is short of virtue, the intellect cannot function reliably and efficiently. The intellect is always the slave of desire, because the intellect plans out how desire may be fulfilled. But if and when, by practice, one sees what one's desire is, the pursuit of pleasure, lust, ambitions, and all the rest of it, all that produces dukkha, then the intellect becomes the faithful servant of true aspiration. Without the intellect, aspiration will not come to fruition. As long as one is short of virtue, the intellect cannot function reliably and efficiently. Where there is virtue and true knowledge, there is peace. He who is virtuous, knowledgeable, and peaceful is one who has power which he will never misuse. One can see throughout history and in our own times, everywhere, that whoever gets power is corruptible. And if he has very great power, he is very, very corruptible. He is also the wise one, the Naga, or sage serpent. Jesus said, "Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves." Comes in Matthew 10:16. Now the Buddha taught us not to cling to virtue. This is frightfully interesting. He ends his parable of the raft, comes in the Alagadupama Sutta, with the words, "The raft of Dhamma, of virtue, is for crossing over the turbulent, dangerous, and frightening waters of samsara to the peaceful shore, and not for retaining." You don't carry the raft about with you afterwards when you've got to the other shore. "Therefore, because you should free yourselves from good mental states, and even more so from evil mental states." Because there arises an attachment to virtue, and one feels, "Oh, I'm a virtuous fellow," and spiritual pride comes in. And he who climbs the ladder of spiritual pride has a worse fall than any other form of pride. The Christian mystic Marguerite Porete, who wrote The Mirror of Simple Souls, made the direct and uncompromising statement so startling to timid piety. Virtues, I take leave of you forevermore. The church failed to understand her. She was burned at the stake in 1310. That book of hers, The Mirror of Simple Souls, is really a wonderful mystical work. It was not known who was the author of it until quite recently, about 15 years ago or so. Professor Romana Guarnieri discovered that it was this lady, Marguerite Porete. She was burned at the stake in 1310. Jacopone da Todi, who lived from 1228 to 1306, a converted lawyer turned mystical poet, wrote, "The war is at an end. In the battle of virtues, in travail of mind, there is no more striving." See, we start with struggling against vices. In this war, the virtues, which are defined by our own imperfect minds, dominate and becloud our perceptions. When we try to pursue a virtue defined by our imperfect minds, we are pursuing something which is not necessarily true virtue. Virtue will emerge by itself, naturally. You see, we have become so unnatural with the development, with the very great development of the cortex in our brains, which lives in uneasy truce with the reptilian and mammalian part of the brain. And so, we define a virtue in our imperfect way. And you will find in every case, practically, that this definition is something which serves your particular ambition or pursuit or desire. Our striving is self-centered, acquisitive. There comes the point when selflessness is realized. Then only the transcendent virtue embodied in us, asha, ritta, dhamma, use whatever word you like, functions freely through us. No further need then to strive for the possession of virtues, for you have become virtue, as was said of the Buddha by himself. He said, the term Tathagata is tantamount to being the Dhamma Bhuta. He had become Dhamma, become virtue, become the truth, become in mind and consciousness. The living religions of the world find a meeting point of unanimity in their teachings of virtue. Perhaps the simplest and most succinct summing up of virtuous living is in Zarathustrianism. Six words: good thoughts, good words, good deeds. Sums up the whole business of virtue. In the Yoga Upanishads, such as the Shandilya and Yoga Tattva and many others, it is distinctly taught that the precepts and virtues must be fully observed in thought and word and deed. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna presents an extensive list of some 17 virtues in the 16th canto, and also several more in other cantos in connection with wisdom and right action. The Old and New Testaments make their rich contribution, and the whole of Buddhism emphasizes virtue preeminently. Virtue is the great transmutative converter of vijnana, discriminative, separative, isolative consciousness, into holistic consciousness. And then you embrace the whole cosmos within your arms. It is verily a magical power to purify and heal the psyche and solve all the problems besetting humanity. It is compounded of humility, harmlessness, and selflessness, of purity, righteousness, and truth, of wisdom, compassion, and goodness, of love, of beauty. Virtue is the song of the spirit.